Hey, Jen here. Just wanted to give a correction for the last couple of episodes. It was brought to our attention on Instagram that Jonestown actually was in South America, not in Africa. And as you can tell, I'm really bad at geography, so I just wanted to apologize and just wanted to give that correction and let you guys know. And thank you. If you ever notice that we do anything incorrectly or report it wrong, please just send us a message on Instagram or just put a comment and we will gladly do a correction. Also, I wanted to give a content warning for today's episode. We do talk about violence and rape, and we do talk about sex. So if any of those things do make you uncomfortable, please just be aware that they will be discussed and that this will be for mature audiences only. Thanks.
Hey, friends. Welcome back to another episode of Cult Killers and Cocktails, hashtag CKC. We just made that up.
Maybe it'll trend. We don't know. We'll see.
Get us trending.
Right now. So, hey, thanks for coming back and
listening to another great episode. And we have some subscribers now. Again, we have listeners all over the world. So that's awesome. Keep it up.
Yeah. And also, please follow us on Instagram if you guys haven't already done that.
The handle is Cults, Killers, and Cocktails. Very simple, so you guys remember it. So, Jen, what kind of updates do you have on your life this week?
I bought a car, and it was actually the first loan since my identity's been stolen that my dad didn't have to co-sign for me. So
I'm so proud of you.
I feel like I'm adulting pretty hard right now, and it's pretty awesome.
You kind of are. What kind of car did you get?
A CRV, so a Honda, so it'll literally last forever. So I'm pretty much going to die in this car.
Basically.
But it's going to be awesome. So
yeah,
I love it. I still can't park anywhere.
Do you have a reverse camera?
I do, but yes. I'm still afraid to use it. And I work in a skyscraper, so I park in a parking garage. And I'm still parking like on the upper floors, so I don't hit anybody. So we're going to get there eventually, but
Baby steps.
Baby steps.
You'll get used to the camera one day, and then like you won't even be able to park without it. Like if you ever have to rent a car and it doesn't have a backup camera, you'll be like, oh my God, what am I doing?
I can't parallel park.
Yeah.
No, well, I can't parallel park anyways. Yeah, but
that won't make a difference. It's fine.
Yeah, going from a Mazda to a big car like that, it's been a change, but it's good.
But you feel like you own the road, right?
Oh, yeah. And I feel like I'm higher than everyone on the road.
Oh, yeah. It's a great change.
I love it. I'm seeing high, loving life. It's good. What about you?
Yeah, I took my dog, my newly adopted greyhound, today to a tennis court to actually see her run.
Aw.
Boy, she run fast, okay? Like, she was tearing up that tennis court, and then as soon as she got done running, she started whimpering. So I was like, oh, God, I broke her. But I think she was just really tired, and she was like, Mom, I'm done racing for a living. I want to go home and sleep.
Right.
So that's what we did.
Well, that's awesome, though.
Yeah. Yeah, so she's a good dog. It's just a lot of adjusting.
Oh, yeah. Well, especially with the snow. Did she hate the snow?
She actually kind of liked it, and I wasn't really expecting that of her. She was doing zoomies in the snow, so that was great. But I just can't wait to make an adulting purchase like you in a couple of weeks and get a privacy fence.
There you go.
So that way she can do all the zoomies, because we don't have one right now. So walking a dog 3 times a day, it's a lot.
And for all of you guys that don't know, we literally got like, what, a foot of snow last week?
And pretty much
shut the city down, so.
Oh, yes.
It was pretty crazy. So, yeah, are you ready to get into this week's story?
I'm so excited to hear about another awful cult.
All right. So this one is called the Sylvanians.
The Sylvanians.
Sylvanians. So it's like Sullivans, but they pronounce it very edgy.
Sylvanians.
Sylvanians. So the Sylvanians were started by Saul B. Newton, who was quite a ladies' man, actually. He actually ended up having 6 wives eventually.
Wow.
Yeah, so this guy definitely knows how to talk to women. He was born in Canada, but he was actually born as Saul Cohen. He changed his name when he went to college and started studying psychology. He went to the University of Wisconsin, and then he moved to Chicago. He was a big union organizer back in his early days, and when he wasn't doing the whole union thing, he was a payroll clerk, which each their own, but seems like a pretty...
That's a pretty big switch.
Yeah, yeah. So he became an official member of the Communist Party at 27 years old.
Okay.
And he was actually also a veteran. He was injured during war, the Spanish Civil War. Met his first wife, Jane in a psychology program. So Jane studied at Radcliffe College until 1932. And then she got her bachelor's degree at University of Texas. Then she ended up studying at the Institute of Individual Psychology in Chicago from 1936 to 1941. So after she gets all the education, she worked at the International Harriet Lane Hospital in Baltimore. And then she was a resident psychiatrist at 27.
So she's an independent woman.
She is independent.
Good for you,
INDE.
Girl.
You got the whole thing. She is awesome. So then eventually after she graduates again, she went to the William Allison Institute in 1949. And then that's where she met him.
Okay.
So they both met through their interest and love of psychology. People said that they weren't really qualified, but she has such a great track record that I think she was pretty qualified in psychology.
I was going to say, she was literally in college for her entire life.
And he also studied it as well. Sol and Jane were influenced by one of the founders of the William Allison White Institute, where they both studied. His name was Harry Stack Sullivan. Okay?
Okay.
The only thing you really need to know about him is that he was a neo-Freudian psychiatrist and psychoanalyst.
I need you to put that in layman's terms.
So, neo-Freudian, they're a group of people that they agree with the basic ideas of Sigmund Freud, but they alter them just a little bit just to include their own versions. And if you know anything about Sigmund Freud, like in Psych 101 in college, yeah. I remember, you know, pretty much men were going to marry someone that's like their mother.
Yeah, like
you know,
the,
all
what's
of those.
The Freud theory or something?
Yeah,
or?
So that's where their basic ideas kind of line up.
Okay.
So they together founded the Sylvanian Institute in 1957. And if you're asking yourself, well, what is this institute? It was an institute where people could actually go there for mental health treatment. Newton's whole idea behind the Sylvanian Institute was he wanted to create an alternative to the traditional nuclear family, which I feel like a lot of cult leaders don't really like the nuclear family. I feel like that's like a common theme
yeah.
that we're starting to see, actually.
Right.
He thought that this was a root cause of all social anxiety.
Okay.
Which I think is kind of weird because I call my sister pretty much all the time for anything and everything.
We literally just got off FaceTime with her. Hey, Katie.
So the cause, that being the cause of anxiety, I don't see what he's doing.
No.
They were also known in the 1960s for not only their therapy, but also for being a polygamous cult.
Okay. So polygamy, that's when you have three partners, right? Four partners, seven.
You can
partners.
Have multiple partners. There's
gotcha.
No limit.
Okay.
Everyone can play in the polygamy game.
I was trying to think what poly meant.
Oh yeah. Multiple.
Oh God.
So you're asking what type of people are trying to join this cult or this, you know, treatment center?
Yes, what type of people?
It was actually a ton of intellectuals, a lot of free thinkers. There was a lot of doctors, lawyers. Yeah, very ambitious people. For example, this guy named Spreacher, and that was his nickname. He was a recent Harvard graduate, and he was trying to find roommates in a new city. And he had heard about the Sylvanians, and then he ended up joining the Institute in 1974. He didn't need therapy, but he just wanted some friends.
So is this like a spot where they stayed or did they just go there and study?
So we'll get into this later, but okay. They actually had three buildings that they owned and they lived there as well.
Okay.
It was like a huge commune, but in like downtown New York.
So they're trying to make it like a college experience, like with dorm rooms or so. I guess we can get into
pretty
it,
much.
Yeah,
so
okay.
Spreacher, he was quoted saying, I found this group and it just so happened that all of them were in Sylvanian therapy. It was an incredibly neat experience for a newcomer in New York City. Suddenly I had a social life. There were women who wanted to date me. We spent the summers in Angheist, and it was very loose in those days, but just people hanging out in apartments. So you're right. It's pretty much like the college experience, but in adult form.
Yeah. I guess that's a new way. If you don't want to make friends on Bumble, you just, you know, join the cult.
Right. Yeah.
Cool.
At least you know what you're getting into.
Yeah.
Newton also thought that all of the mental blame and everything that you experience is because of your mom.
Excuse me?
So he doesn't like nuclear family. He obviously doesn't like mothers, so someone has mommy issues.
Oh, for real?
Yeah, he was crazy. So he tried to control all aspects of his followers' lives. They had to abide by everything he said. One of the things that he made them do was have sex with everybody. Everyone slept with everybody.
Here we go.
There were no relationships, which I thought was kind of weird because he was married. And if you wanted relationships, you had to get approval from him.
Right. I see that's a common theme too.
Yeah. You can't have these relationships.
Yeah.
It wasn't just that everyone could sleep with whoever they want. It was almost like it was a game. They had a thing called a fuck rota. And it was this huge thing that was displayed in the communal buildings. that everyone lived at. And pretty much what you do is you would like spin the wheel and you would find out who you're sleeping with for that night.
Wheel of Fortune, sex edition.
Yeah, literally.
Do they have a game show host? Or
what's the prize?
Yeah. Do I get to pick the hottest one? I guess not, because you're on the wheel.
Well, and that's the thing. What if you like spin on something? Even if you're someone that likes polygamy, great, you know, each their own. But what if you get someone you're really not attracted to? Do you have to go through with it for the night?
Can you imagine like being on the wheel and getting like this, like the hottest person there, the one that you're really attracted to, and then the wheel like moves to the next thing?
No!
Yeah,
it was just crazy. And the thing was that when you lived in these apartments, you had to live with the people of your same sex. So like if you and I were part of the cult, we would have to live in an apartment together. There was no like, I live with a man, vice versa. So I don't know if it was one of those things where I put a sock on the doorknob for my day, you know, and then you have to come back later. That was one thing that no one ever really talked about, which was my first question.
Interesting, yeah.
And if you wanted to have kids, you had to, again, get approval from Saul. His next wife, Fogarty, she had the great idea that if someone wanted to have a kid, they would actually have to get multiple partners to have sex with them in the same period, so they had no idea who the father was.
Oh, good. So we're just turning this into a Maury game show now.
Literally.
We got Wheel of Fortune, now we got Maury.
Because they don't like the nuclear family ties, so they don't want you to feel like you're connected to somebody.
Right. Wow.
Yeah. The children that were born in these groups, they were shipped off to boarding school as soon as they were of age, or they were given to caretakers if they weren't old enough to go to boarding school, and their parents were only allowed to visit them for an hour or two a day.
Oh my gosh. So kind of a backtrack question. So did he divorce Jane and marry this new person, or is he still married to Jane?
Oh no, he divorced. He's okay. Very into divorce.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
And while he's married to people, we'll get into this later, but he's also having sex with whoever he wants in the cult.
I mean, I'm not surprised.
Right. He also made his members do weekly mandated therapy sessions. And during these sessions, not only him, but other therapists that were part of this group would advise them to cut off all contact with the outside world, no family, no friends, and to give them money.
Give them money. How are they making money?
Well, think about it. All these people are like doctors and lawyers, and you know, there's also your hippie people, but they have money and they have means to. Some of the cult members also received instructions to like what jobs they should take in order to make more money for the Institute. Leaders would actually give fines against people, too, who did things like if they showed too much interest in their children. It was like a $10,000 fine.
Oh.
$10,000 fine. And this is like back in the 60s.
You're being, yeah, so that's a lot more today.
Yeah, I don't know what the inflation rate is, but I know it's something crazy.
Alexa. Just kidding, Alexa.
Sorry.
Oh,
I'm not sure.
Oh, there she goes.
There she goes.
So another ex-member, we had Spreacher, and another one, Michael Bray, they said that during some of these obligatory meetings, therapists would show them old childhood photos. They would insinuate that their mothers didn't love them and they were disgusted by them.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, so they want to install this hatred of your mom. That is one of their main goals of this therapy technique that they used. Bray, for example, said that he was so convinced by this tactic that he started obeying all the Institute's orders. He divorced his wife so he could abide by, you know, the free love and be able to be with whoever he wanted to. And he also made sure that other followers were taking part of their weekly mandated therapy sessions and taking it very seriously. Other ex-members said that during these therapy sessions, they were told multiple things that were very, very horrible. Like, for example, that their mothers loathed them and that they were just as evil as the SS during the Holocaust.
Wow.
So pretty much these therapy sessions just tore people down.
That's very dramatic.
Yeah. So he goes on, Saul does, our man Saul, and he gets another divorce. Now he marries Joan Harvey in the 1970s. She was known for being a soap opera actor and an aspiring stage director. So she's more into the liberal arts.
Gotcha.
This time in the 1970s, there was hundreds of people living in these three buildings in the Upper West Side of New York. So it's growing more and more. They also owned about $12 million in property, including the Catskills Resort, which, like, if you ever see some movies, there it's like the equivalent of going to, I'm trying to think of like a place where rich people go, like on vacation and stuff, to go skiing or something.
Not Honolulu. there's like
Aspen, you know, it's gotcha. Like the Aspen. Gotcha. We're going to Aspen or something like that. They had a house in Vermont. They had the two and three buildings on the Upper West Side. Third was rental. Two they actually owned. And again, all this wealth came from their members because they were instructed to contribute their money for the benefit of the group.
Wow.
They had the group mentality. So let's fast forward to the late 1970s. It was Harvey's idea to actually merge the therapy group with a theater collective group. And that group was called the Fourth Wall. When they joined them with the Fourth Wall, things started getting crazy. In 1978, the building troupe signed a lease at Truck and Warehouse Theater in the East Village, and that's in New York. When the current company refused to vacate the theater, hundreds of civilians took over the space, destroyed their sets, and a lot of them actually got arrested. Then in 1979, the meltdown at Three Mile Island happened in the United States.
What is that?
So it was a nuclear meltdown. It happened in Pennsylvania, and it freaked a lot of people out because it was pretty much a radiation leak.
Oh, that's terrifying.
Yeah, that not as bad as Chernobyl, obviously.
Obviously.
But it still freaked a lot of people out.
Right.
The group went insane. They fled to Orlando because they thought Manhattan was going to be destroyed. They were there for 2 weeks. And then when they came back, the people that didn't go, because they were like, the guy's insane, it's literally going to be fine, they were all kicked out.
Why? Do they think they're going to spread radiation poisoning like COVID or something?
No, they were like, you didn't believe in our leader, so now you're out of the group.
Ah.
Because you didn't show your devotion.
Gotcha.
Mike Bray, the guy that we were talking about earlier, after this incident, said paranoia, beliefs, and distortions of reality began to set in the group after this happened. Particularly among Saul Newton and Joan Harvey. The group had recently required the resort in the Catskills, where Bray was soon dispatched to build a secret steel-lined room with quarter-inch plates so that Joan Harvey could go in there and edit her film. So she was an actress, so if she went in to edit her film, she wanted to do it under these steel plates because she thought that everyone was after her. She was being bugged. The CIA was after her. They just started getting very, very paranoid about everything, even though no one was really after them.
Man, that's like super paranoid right there. Girl, you know they can still place bugs in those steel rooms.
Yeah, they actually bought a bunch of buses and motorcycles in case of an emergency, and they had a plan to evacuate the city.
Wow.
Yeah, so they had evacuation plans. They were very serious about everything. In 1980s, Newton was diagnosed with dementia, so his health was starting to decline. Yeah, at that time, in the 1980s, two custody suits were filed by Michael Bray and Paul Spreacher, who we both talked about earlier. They brought public suits, and they wanted to actually have custody of their children. And when that happened, they brought up the group's violent tendencies and the controversial child-rearing practice, because obviously they did not treat their kids well.
Clearly, yeah.
They had no love from their family. And when this happened, they started getting a bunch of media attention. Newton, like we said, he has dementia, and the way that he wanted to problem solve was by intimidation and violence. And he started to tell that to his followers. So July 29th, 1985, Sylvanians believed that there were residents near them that poured paint on their buildings, and they wanted to retaliate. They wanted to get them back. Cult members beat their neighbors with blunt objects and smashed like all of their possessions before like running from the scene.
Without any proof or anything, they just think that they did it?
Yeah. Also, someone reported in 1985 that they decided that they wanted to leave the group. And when they wanted to leave the group, someone tracked them down, assaulted them in Union Station. And according to the court documents, they dangled him over the subway tracks and threatened to kill him.
That would be a way to go.
Yeah. In retrospect, after Bray left, he viewed the Sylvanians as a manipulative cult.
Oh, good.
He said they preyed on people. He said they made that they got their power by making people feel troubled and vulnerable and by cutting them off from all their families and loved ones. And while Bray viewed them as manipulative, Eric Gouin, who is a recluse now, and he spent 12 years in the group beginning in 1979, he stated that he only has positive memories of the group. Quote, if you really want to get a sense of what it's like, you have to talk to the people who have no interest talking to you. So I think what he meant by that was everyone that has been interviewed about the group, they've been interviewed because they've had bad experiences.
So kind of like bad Yelpers.
Right.
Like when you're Yelping somebody, you're pissed off at a restaurant. Gotcha.
Okay. The only thing I have to say about that was even Newton's daughter, Esther, his eldest daughter, was not interested in his community. She didn't join it. She was quoted saying, he was both hated and loved. His ideas were lofty. Their results are for others to judge. But he was very bright and creative, charismatic, and definitely difficult, handsome, and attractive to women, and tyrannical.
I'm surprised that she wasn't forced to join it.
Yeah, but if you think about it, they probably shipped her off to boarding school. And at that point, you grew up making your own decisions. You know what I mean?
I guess so. But you think that they would be like, come back from boarding school, join, you know, daddy's cult.
Yeah. So eventually the group just died out with all the controversy, all the violence that was going on. People kind of got fed up with it. And now it's no longer a thing.
Really?
Newton died at 85 years old. He died of sepsis after suffering from Alzheimer's disease.
So his dementia led into that?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. Dementia led into Alzheimer's, and then he ended up just dying. So Helen Fogarty, who was his last wife, actually lost her license. It was revoked in 1977, which was 6 years after her and Newton divorced, and she left the group.
And what kind of license was that?
Psychology license.
Oh, so she was a psychologist.
She was a counselor over there, and she's 73 years old today. She's still alive.
Oh.
And the state, for the first time ever, well, the only time, has actually put her on probation and restored her license.
At 73?
At 73 years old, but only with the condition that she practices under supervision.
Okay, that would be super awkward for a new patient. Can you imagine? I have to practice under this guy sitting in the corner over here listening to you.
And I'm 73 years old.
And I'm 73 years old. I'd be like, no, thank you.
Yeah. Like we said, she's remarried and she does still counsel under supervision. And she counsels foster children, focusing on abuse, neglect, and delinquent kids.
So she's more of a child. Okay, well.
Which is crazy because they were so against kids in their group. It's crazy that she totally switched her practice. She's active in her church and she's actually a very, very involved lupus advocate.
Does she have lupus?
She doesn't have lupus, but she just wants to advocate on behalf of people.
I mean, whatever you're passionate about, baby, go for it.
Yeah. In an article I read said that she played Santa Claus at a community gathering.
Like Santa Claus, not.
I guess they were just trying to put light on the fact that she's turning over a new leaf and she's all about the kids because she played Santa Claus.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's the Sylvanians. Like I said, it was pretty much a... this was a cult, but it was also more of just a group that pretty much wanted to hang out together and have a lot of sex.
Now a few groups like that. It's crazy how they just died out and they just kind of like evaporated, like boiling water that just evaporates over time.
Well, then the times changed too. I mean, they were popular for a few years. And then after that, I feel like the hippie phase kind of died out in United States culture.
Do you think people knew that they were in a cult, like, or were they so invested into the institute that they didn't even realize that they were in a cult?
I feel like if I was going somewhere and I was getting therapy, but I had to live there, and then when I lived there, I was forced into having random hookups each night and wasn't able to make my own decision about who I wanted to be with.
Right.
And they're also saying, give me money, you know.
Right.
And cut off your friends and family. Then I classify that as a cult. I think they knew.
Oh, yeah.
I think they were well aware.
Okay. Wow. That's crazy. That's a good one, though. I like that one.
Yeah. So that was the Sylvanians. And yeah. So cults in New York. Who would have known?
Cults in New York.
So do you want to tell us about what we're drinking tonight?
Yes. So, Jen, you had mentioned earlier that half the country got obliterated by a snowstorm.
Right.
So the theme, or my theme this week anyway, is snow.
All right.
So this is called a snowball martini. What you're going to do first is you're going to get a martini glass and you're going to put a sugar rim on it.
I thought I tasted something awesome.
Oh, yes. Sugar is great. Lots of carbs. This recipe is for about 3 to 4 people. You're going to get 2 ounces of vanilla vodka, 4 ounces of coconut flavored rum, 2 ounces of cream of coconut, and 6 ounces of half and half. Shake that all together in a shaker and pour it in the martini glass, and you will have a yummy meal.
It is a meal because this is literally our dinner right now.
It literally is.
But it is amazing.
It's very good. It's a little strong. So if you like coconut, you will love this.
Yeah, it's like a Malibu, but on steroids.
Yeah, basically. So it's really good. So, sticking to the theme of snow this week, and again, being obliterated, I decided to do a serial killer that is in a cold state, which the coldest state is Alaska.
And there's not that many people that live there.
There's
no, I'm thinking of Antarctica.
There's not. Penguins live in Antarctica.
And research scientists.
And them. Kind of jealous of them, but not really. But I'm not going to tell you who it is yet. So, on August 31st, 2000, 33-year-old Della Brown was trying her best in life in Anchorage, Alaska. She was a bingo hostess at a local spot in town. She was a well-known, likable lady, and one of the things that she was known for was her always smiling face. But despite this outgoing, chipper personality, she was hiding her demons under her face. So, Della had a drug and alcohol problem that she had struggled with for years. She would go on spurts of being sober for a while, and then life would happen, and she would fall back into the addiction. On this particular August night, Della was back on the downward spiral. She went to a local bar and decided she was going to drink the night away. 3 days later, on September 2nd, Della's body was found dead in a shack. She was lying on her back with her blue jeans down to her ankles, bra and blue tank top pushed above both of her breasts. Her head was so concave from being beaten by a rock that one officer described her skull felt like a bag of melting ice.
Ew.
That's pretty beat in.
Yeah.
So this shack was in a rough part of Anchorage. It was kind of known as like a bad habit shack. So people such as like prostitutes, illegal gambling, and drugs would always be passing through here. So officers were pretty perplexed by this, and they didn't have really anything to go on. Although their assumption was that she was beaten to death by a rock, there were no bloody rocks in the area. Officers were also pretty concerned at this point. See, there were several dead bodies found in the Anchorage area as well. They were all unsolved because they were random murders, which left them very little to go on.
Right.
They were concerned that a serial killer was on the loose. Anchorage police put out a news segment to the public basically saying, hey everyone, if you know anything about the murder of Della Brown, please contact us immediately. There is a reward involved. So, soon after publishing that, they get a very odd tip from a person who hung out with a 20-year-old man named Joshua Wade. This informant claimed that he had been taken to see the body after she was dead. So, the informant's side of the story is that a group of them were out one night and they had plans to go to a liquor store and drink whiskey and just kind of have like a low-key night, which basically is like our dream. So Joshua Wade was the driver, and as they were driving, they saw a lady passed out in the road, but she was kind of more like to the side of it. The informant claims that Josh got super excited when he saw this passed out lady and wanted to run her over.
Wait, what?
Yeah. And after being a little shocked, the friend's like, no, dude, chill. Like, let's just pick her up and drop her off at the shed.
Right.
So she'll, like, have shelter. So Josh agrees to this. And then they leave the shed and continue driving so they can continue their plans. Once they get to a buddy's house, Josh says, hey, guys, I'm going to go back to that shed to see if that chick has any money on her, and leaves. Which these weren't the best group of people anyway, so they're like, okay, whatever, man.
And we know for sure she was passed out. She wasn't dead at this point, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. She was still breathing. So when he returns a couple of hours later, he has blood all over his sweater. And he casually says, hey guys, come with me. I want to show you something.
And it's a couple of hours later.
So all his friends get back in the car and Josh drives them to the shed and they see a dead Della in cold blood. And as Josh is bragging about killing Della to them, this informant also claims that Josh started to brag about three other dead people that had been recently reported in the newspapers. So police are honestly, like, pretty excited about this. I mean, this sounds like an open and shut case.
Right.
So just to give a little background on Josh, honestly, he's a serial killer that does not have a lot of information out there on the web. Just to kind of give you an idea, he was born in 1980 in Anchorage, but I couldn't actually find his actual date of birth.
Wow.
Yeah. So it is known, however, that he grew up with a single mom. His mom worked a lot to try to make the best life for them. And while she was working, she would let the next door neighbor babysit little Joshua. Years later, Joshua claimed that the neighbor started molesting him at 5 years old. and this lasted for a long time. So, traumatic event. At age 12, he was committing petty crimes and was well acquainted with the law. And he's in and out of detention centers for all of his teenage years. And meanwhile, I was playing with my Bratz dolls at that time.
Right.
But at age 16, he was caught carrying a fully loaded handgun.
I wonder where he got it from.
That's a very good point. Black market, maybe?
Maybe, yeah.
Alaskan black market. At age 19, he was already a full-fledged felon. And then at 20 years old is when the murder of Della happened. So now we're back to current events. On September 30th, 2000, 28 days after Della Brown's body was discovered, they arrested Joshua Wade. He is charged with sexual assault, murder, and evidence tampering. And the evidence tampering comes from a shovel that was near the scene, and apparently they found his fingerprints on it.
Okay, so they have something that actually connects him to the scene besides the witness.
Exactly. But Josh denies everything, so they go to trial. So we've talked about in the past couple of episodes how defense cases for serial killers are pretty stupid.
Right.
But this one's actually pretty solid. The defense basically says, look, there was no DNA of Josh's found on Della's body. You didn't find a murder weapon. You're basically just going off witness testimony, and you don't have the most credible sources. Yeah, he may have said that he killed her to his friends, but he's just trying to be cool and fit in. He just stumbled upon the body and wanted to fit in with his other criminal pals.
As much as I can see that, I don't know. It just still seems off.
It is. Very off. The unthinkable happens. Joshua Wade is acquitted of all his charges except for witness tampering with the shovel, since they did have his fingerprints on it. Della's mom was in the courtroom and she literally broke down.
That poor mother. I can't even imagine.
No. So he is sentenced to 3 years in prison. And as he's walking away, Josh like makes a face at the Anchorage Police Department because they're in the courtroom, and he kind of lunges at them in a way.
Really?
Yeah. And the bailiff just like takes him off.
Maybe he was doing that for street cred before he gets into prison. Maybe. To be like, yeah, I lunged at them.
Yeah.
I'm so angry. I'm so tough.
Right. So an officer on the case quoted, "This case was a perfect storm. We didn't have any witnesses to the actual killing of Della. The informants had a pretty rough past, and by the time that we went to trial, they were going to court for their own charges. You combine all those three together, and it makes for a pretty difficult case."
That's true.
So, he serves his 3 years, and on December 3rd, 2006, he is released from jail like nothing ever happened. Fast forward 9 months after his release date, in early morning hours, literally 1:30 in the morning, of Saturday, August 4th, 2006, psychiatric nurse practitioner Mindy Sloss is unwinding with a glass of wine after a busy week. She lives in Anchorage, but works in Anchorage and Fairbanks. So she's kind of like a traveling NP. So she'll stay in Anchorage 1 week, and then the next week she'll travel to Fairbanks.
Right.
So she's just, you know, unwinding, planning her week out. Later in the day, her best friend Jerry calls her, but she doesn't get an answer. And she doesn't call back either. Although odd, Jerry just figures she's out picking blueberries, which is apparently her favorite hobby. And she calls again on Sunday. Jerry calls Mindy, and there's still no answer, and her voicemail was full. So she's like, man, maybe she must have just found a lot of blueberries, and she's busy baking. So Jerry is the friend that takes care of her cat while she's gone. On Monday, regardless of her not answering her phone calls, she heads over to Mindy's house, only she notices a few things. One, the doorknob was weird. It was locked, but it was loose. Two, there were dishes piled up in the sink, and there was an entire empty bottle of wine on the counter and a ton of open bills on the table. Mindy was a neat freak. This would have never happened. Three, the car was in the garage. Fairbanks is 360 miles away, and she always flew. This was definitely not ordinary, as I hope you would do if I were to go missing like that. I would hope that you would call my supervisor, because that's what Jerry did. She called Mindy's supervisor.
Well, yeah, you know, if they're not coming into work, there is a real issue.
Yeah. Would you do that for me?
For sure.
Okay, cool. So her supervisor states that Mindy did not show up for work, and now she's really freaking out. But at the same time, Jerry also freaked Mindy's boss out because this wasn't like Mindy. So her boss calls the police, and the police basically say, give it another day. She'll show up.
They always want people to wait one more day for missing persons, and I don't understand it. just look.
If anybody ever goes missing in your life, fight the police on it, please. Because it might be okay, but it might not. So the next day, she was still a no-show. So her boss calls the police again. So the police are like, fine, we'll finally do our jobs. So the police go to the airport records and they discover that Mindy never boarded her plane. Now police are like, okay, we're going to put a trace on all her information and see if something pings. 2 days later, there is bank activity on her debit card that went through. $500 was withdrawn from a Wells Fargo ATM.
I wonder who that was.
Mm-hmm. Police look at ATM footage at 4:58 in the morning, and they see a male with a dark baseball cap and a blue and white bandana over his face. He gets the money out and then quickly returns when he realizes that dummy forgot the debit card.
Wow.
In the machine. So, since there are safety measures on the machine, the card was essentially eaten.
Good.
By the machine.
You so, go, like, Wells Fargo. I don't appreciate you because of the student loans I had, but sponsor you did something
us
well, right.
Sponsor us, Wells Fargo. But, so, it's basically like a safety measure, so the next user doesn't get it. So, frustrated and slightly freaking out, the man pulls down his bandana a few times, as if that's going to help him see better. So, the police get a really good look at his face.
Good.
So, they also see another ATM user, aka a possible witness to the suspect. After 3 weeks of intense searching, they finally track down the witness. And the witness basically says, yeah, I saw him, but I don't know how you guys expect me to describe him. It was 5 a.m. and it was dark.
Yeah, and the guy obviously was not trying to be seen or noticed.
Right, and he had a bandana on. So what is this guy going to do?
And a hat, so.
And a hat. So now they're like, okay, it's time to bring in the FBI. So the FBI starts to eliminate witnesses. She had a boyfriend at the time, but he was able to prove that he was in another city. She also had contractors in the house at the time because she was remodeling, but they were cleared as well. And they check out the neighborhood as well to see if there's any, you know, creepy lurkers around or something. So a friend calls into the FBI and states that she thinks that she saw Mindy's red Acura near the airport in a parking lot. So they go to the car and they compare plates, and it is in fact her car. They find her missing purse, wallet, everything except the ATM card. On the airport surveillance camera, it shows a male parking the car and then just casually walking away. And of course, the video on the surveillance camera was too grainy to make anything of it.
Well, yeah, because nobody ever updates their cameras.
Get better security cameras, people. Then it was decided to bring in the big dogs, and I mean that literally, they brought in the canines. So they scan the car from top to bottom, collecting DNA, fingerprints, and having the bloodhound sniff the hell out of it. And they also smell the ATM where the money was withdrawn. And the bloodhounds immediately get a positive match, meaning they were tugging on their leashes ready to catch the bad guy. Interestingly, they led the police directly to Mindy's neighborhood, to the side door of a house that police had actually previously looked at in the beginning. All of the neighbors told police to check out this house. No one knew who actually lived there because there were always people going in and out. So it was essentially like a party house.
Right.
So it was always loud, rambunctious. So they knew that they had the house. They just didn't have the person.
And if there's a lot of people going in and out of it, it's going to make it way more complicated.
Exactly. So, again, they put out another Anchorage news segment releasing the ATM video and asking the public for help. A young woman was watching the news segment, and she couldn't believe her eyes. That was her friend, Joshua Wade.
What?
Crazy. On the ATM footage. She occasionally gave him rides to places since he didn't have a car and just gave him a ride the day prior. I mean, shocking. He doesn't have a car, you know. So he left his backpack in her car, which is the same backpack seen on the ATM video, because apparently he was wearing a backpack. So she immediately calls the FBI to identify the man in the video. Since they now have a name, they get a search warrant for the mysterious house.
Good.
In a room, they find the same jacket from the ATM video, as well as a receipt from Mindy's account in the jacket.
Seriously?
He's
not as smart as I thought he was.
No. He's pretty dumb. They bring in the bloodhounds to sniff his shoes, and they get a scent. So now they for sure have a connection between the car, the ATM, and the house. So it's slowly piling together, But there's still one problem. There's still no body.
You always need the body.
Gotta have them bones. There wasn't enough evidence to charge him on murder, and they weren't going to have a Della repeat happen. But they did have enough to charge him with bank fraud. It was a minimum 2-year sentence, which would give them time to properly put together a murder charge against him. So they're being smart about this time. But there was also another problem on top of those two. Josh had suspicion that the police were onto him since they were constantly canvassing the neighborhood, so he was on the run. So when the public announcement was made, Josh's dad actually tries to speak to him. And he says, "I love him. I love you, Josh. I just want you to turn yourself in." Which, imagine,
that's heartbreaking.
Imagine your dad saying that, which that would never happen.
But still, that's heartbreaking.
Right. So he doesn't turn himself in for his dad, but amazingly, Josh shows up at his ride friend's house to ask for another ride.
I wonder how that conversation went. Obviously, she had to pretend that she didn't know anything, but can you imagine how freaked out you would be?
Right. So that's actually what I was going to say. She's internally freaking out. And she plays it cool. She says no and makes up the excuse to go up to the house to have some cigarettes. But she'll be right back. When she's in the house, she immediately calls the FBI. And he's like, she's gone for too long. And he actually flees the scene. And she sees him running off. And this girl's a badass because she's on the phone with the FBI chasing Josh.
No way.
Down the street.
That is epic.
Like, girl, give me some of your balls that you have because you're amazing. So Josh goes into an apartment complex and he bangs on an apartment door and he ends up busting it in. The SWAT team arrives and he has a hostage, which was a girl that was living there. And they had no idea if Josh was armed or not. So the SWAT team was like, you have two options. You can either turn yourself in or you're going to get shot during a standoff. And Josh isn't very confident in his escape abilities. So he goes with option one and just like turns himself in, like just walks out the door.
Great.
On September 2nd, 2007, almost 1 month after Mindy's disappearance, Joshua Wade is arrested. The FBI takes him to headquarters and starts their questioning. Only they take a super interesting approach to this. The FBI agent told Josh that he was being charged for bank fraud, which was true.
Right.
But Josh says, bank fraud? No, you're just assuming this. And the agent replies, no, we talked to Mindy.
Good.
And Josh pauses and he said, what? You playing games with me, man? And the agent replies, no, we talked to her. She said you stole her bank card. And Josh begins to smirk and chuckle. And then he says, you're bullshitting me. And that's honestly like all the confirmation that the FBI agent needed, even though like they still don't prove it. They're like, okay, this guy did it. But there's still no body. Again, not enough evidence. So he's again only being charged on bank fraud until September 13th, 2007, 11 days after Josh was arrested for fraud, a construction worker sees something out of the ordinary in the woods. Would you like to guess what he saw?
A body in the woods.
Shocking. But it's burned. It is a female, though. So police are immediately dispatched to the area, and they find bullets and shell casings. So they end up taking the skeleton. They end up taking the skeleton, and they check it against dental records, and they are able to confirm that this is the body of Mindy Schloss. While friends are grieving, police are sealing their airtight case against Josh. The bloodhounds confirm his scent on her to match Josh, and his DNA is found on her body.
Even after it was burned?
I guess so. Does DNA last through fire?
I have no idea. I just mean like the scent with the dogs. You think that would like obstruct their scent?
Yeah, I didn't think about that.
Huh.
Got some good sniffers out there. So at first, being typical Josh, he's denying everything. But after realizing all the evidence is literally piling against him, he decides to plead guilty to torturing and killing Mindy. But there's a twist. He also agrees to confess to murdering Della.
Really?
See, Alaska didn't have the death penalty, but bank fraud is considered federal. So, if they could prove that the bank fraud was related to Mindy's murder, which they very likely could, they would go after the death penalty. Isn't that crazy? Death by bank fraud.
That's his first smart decision he's made this entire
time. Exactly.
Wow.
So the story he tells for Mindy is that he just wanted to rob her. He broke into her house the early morning hours of August 4th, most likely when she was enjoying her glass of wine. He bound her hands and legs with zip ties. He made her give him her debit card PIN. He then gagged her with a rag, then wrapped duct tape all around her head. He shoved Mindy into the back seat of her own car and then drove for an entire hour, which, can you imagine how that hour would have been in the back of your own car?
No, there's no way.
So he took her to a wooded area in an undeveloped subdivision, which why construction guy found him. This is where he brought her into the woods and shot her point blank in the back of the head. And I'm honestly calling bullshit that he just wanted to rob her.
You don't go through all of that if you just want to rob somebody. You would have left them there, tied up, and wait until their friends find them.
Exactly. Like, if you truly just wanted to rob somebody, they would be alive. So he then goes back to Mindy's house to make things look normal. He makes her bed, but he steals her watch. So I don't know how that makes it look normal. And he dumped her car at the airport to make it look like she got on a plane and flew away. He then later went to the ATM to get her money. So after all this evidence, and it's kind of cute because Della's mom is actually at this trial as well.
Right.
Mindy. So he's sentenced to life in prison. But of course, Josh is always full of surprises. When the judge was sentencing him, the judge belittled him. He called him a coward for attacking a defenseless woman that he had never met. This made Josh upset. So upset, he stands up and he exclaims, "What about the men?"
What?
Dun, dun, dun. Over the years, Josh has been in prison and has confessed to multiple murders of men. He confessed to killing John Mitchell in 1994, meaning Josh was only 14 years old when he committed his first murder. He also confessed to killing Henry Ongtushruk. I know I butchered that last name. But the same night that he killed Della. So remember the shed that was in the beginning, like it was a bad habit shed?
Right.
So it's possible that, this is just my theory, it's possible that if when Josh went back to the shed, this guy showed up at it.
And then he decided to take care of him.
Exactly. So Josh knocked him out and he put him in the trunk of the car. He said a while later, he heard banging on the trunk lid like someone was trying to get out. And he said he then opened the trunk. He drug the guy out of it and he stomped on his head until he was dead. He then took the body to a creek nearby and dumped it in there. However, no body was ever found.
It's a creek.
Exactly. So
I don't know if I believe that one as much just because someone would have found that body.
Exactly. So, but friends of Josh say that they strongly believe he has killed more women, but he has never admitted to any more, just kind of like the type of guy he was. He was originally in Anchorage, Alaska prison, but he wrote that he was being mistreated, so he got moved to another federal prison in the States. Can you guess what state?
Indiana.
Yep. And I'm guessing Terre Haute, because I feel that it's where all like the big wigs end up.
It is. It's a nice prison.
Is it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We'll have to go visit sometime. Just kidding. However, he's been transferred several times, and now I believe he is in Waymark, Pennsylvania prison. Wherever he is said to be one of the most, quote, assaultive, predatory, disruptive prisoners, according to a past prison guard experience. It is believed to this day he spends most of his time in solitary confinement, and that is the story of Joshua Wade.
That's crazy. And I wonder, too, if he tried to admit to killing men just in order to get, like, a better street cred when he was in prison. Because, like, anyone, I feel like they, when guys are in prison, I feel like men view, like, anyone can kill a woman. But if you've already killed a man, I'm not going to mess with you.
That's a very good
point. Especially, like, multiple men.
That's a very good point. Yeah. And it's crazy that he would still, like, try to impress. You know.
Always impress.
Always impress. Never distress. I just made that up.
I like it. Coining it.
Yeah. But yeah. So, that's a story. And he was in Alaska. And I was like, hey, we've got ripped to shreds by snow this week. Let's do somebody with the snow.
I love it. I've never heard that one before. Yeah. That one was super interesting. That's crazy, though.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Thank goodness for that Wells Fargo ATM, man. That changed everything.
It really did, though. I just don't understand why he pulled down his bandana. Like, I guess he was like freaking out. And
people get flustered and they want to see and they think, I mean, with masks, you see people when they get flustered now pull it down.
Yeah.
If they want to talk or, you know, be able to focus on something.
We can hear you through your mask.
Yeah, it's okay. You don't need to take it down, Karen.
No.
Well, awesome. Well, thanks. And that was really, really good. That's crazy. I'm still reeling about it. Yeah. And if you guys have any stories that you want to hear, feel free to reach out to us on Instagram via the direct message. And please keep following us. Tell us to all your friends.
Yes. Like us and leave a review for us, guys. I think we're on episode 5 right now. We can start asking for them to leave reviews, right?
Yeah, I say so.
Okay, leave us a review, please. And if it's going to be bad, then don't
leave it.
Don't do it. But if it's good, then leave it on every platform you can think of.
Well, thanks for listening, and we hope to see you guys next week.
See you guys later.
Bye, friends.
Bye. Hi, everyone. Vanessa here. Just wanted to tell you about my sources that I use for Joshua Wade. I use robinbearfield76.medium.com. She is an Alaskan wilderness mystery author and podcaster. I also watched an FBI criminal pursuit documentary on Joshua Wade, gave a lot of great information. And last but not least, I used wickedwee.com. If you have any questions, let us know. Thanks.
Jen here with my sources for today's episode. I found a lot of my episode research online, including the ex-psychotherapy and sex commune leader permitted to practice again on www.lohud.com, how a psychosexual cult tried to tear apart my family on newyorkpost.com, I love the Upper West Side.com, inside an Upper West Side sex cult, Saul Newton, 85, psychotherapist and leader of commune dies from the New York Times, inside the rise and fall of a 1970s Upper West Side cult from gotemist.com, crazy psychotherapy cult, The Sylvanians on YouTube from the YouTube channel. American Cult, 5 spiritual groups that went way too far from the Rolling Stones. Thank you.